So with that, I'm going to turn things over, reminding everyone to keep their phone lines on mute, to our very first instructor today for the updates on renewable energy development on contaminated land, looking at community involvement and useful information tools, which is being sponsored by the EPA's Office of Superfund Remediation and Technology Innovation. Laura Knudsen was an intern here at the EPA's Technology Innovation Office, and she's going to start things off. So go ahead, Laura.
Hi, thanks Jean. Thanks everyone who's listening on the phone or streaming this presentation online. Just a brief note before we get going. As it says on slide number one, the topic of this presentation is community involvement and renewable energy reuse on Superfund sites. But I just want to say, as noted in the description of this presentation, a lot of the community involvement strategies and community involvement opinions that I've discovered throughout the course of my research I feel can be applied to contaminated land sites in general, not just to Superfund sites. That's why I made it open. I feel it can reach a broader audience. So with that said, going on to slide number two, I've included a list of acronyms in case you're not familiar with them, so please take a moment to familiarize yourself with them. And if you're confused by any acronyms I used during the presentation, go ahead and refer back to this slide, slide number two. Moving on to slide number three, I just want to give a quick overview of my presentation. I'll begin with the precedents for my project and then leading right into a quick overview of my project as well as the methodology that I used. And then we'll delve right into the case studies that are really the meat of my project. We'll be talking about the Brightfield project in Brockton, Massachusetts, which is a wind turbine project in Lackawanna, New York. Then we'll be going on to the Abtex Fiber site, which is an actual Superfund project right now going on in Front Royal, Virginia, where a solar project is in discussion. And lastly, we'll be talking about the Nebraska Ordnance Plant, which had a successful reuse project initially at the Superfund site, but the reuse project did not end up coming to fruition at the event. It actually had to close. Then that will be followed with a community involvement flowchart that I created it has a super fun focus to it, but it's really meant for people, and you could really apply it to contaminated land sites, but you'll do some site alterations, but it's really for anyone who's interested in a renewable energy reuse project to kind of start thinking about the factors that would go into a successful renewable energy reuse project from a community involvement perspective. And that will be followed.
Laura, this is Jean. I'm sorry. We do have someone on the line who's breathing very heavily into their phone. I don't think it's you, and I don't think it's Pam. A reminder, please keep your phone on mute. Use your own mute button or hit *6. If I continue to hear the breathing, I will globally mute everyone, and at that point, Laura, I'll have to have you press *6 on your line to continue. But I'll pop in if I need to do that. Sorry about that. Thank you.
Okay. And so just the last thing that I'll be talking about is a compilation of community involvement tools that I've acquired from my discussions with community involvement trainers and some remedial project managers. And then my presentation will be followed by Pamela Swingle from EPA Region 4, who has done a lot of work on tools to assess renewable energy potential, such as the Google Earth mapping tool. And she'll be talking about those and other incentives as well. So moving on to slide number four, really the principal precedents for my project kind of originated in 1999 with the Superfund Redevelopment Initiative, which is an initiative promoted by EPA, which really made people really start to focus on reuse at an early stage in the cleanup process. So instead of thinking about reuse at the very end of a cleanup phase, thinking about reuse from the very beginning. And this provided some pilot money originally for reuse projects and also began the role of Superfund redevelopment coordinators, which each of the 10 regions that EPA has a Superfund redevelopment coordinator, and it's their responsibility to help and assist Superfund sites with reuse projects and provide support to the project teams at those sites. And this leads nicely into the Repairing Versus Land Initiative, which was launched last year at the 2008 Brownfield Conference. And this initiative, promoted by the EPA, has a specific reuse focus, which is renewable energy reuse. And renewable energy meaning solar power, such as solar panels, solar fields, wind power, like wind turbines and wind fields, also biomass, biofuels, geothermal power, and also increasingly methane gas reuse from landfill sites. And the kind of lands that this initiative covers are contaminated lands in general. So not just Superfund sites are included, but also brownfield sites, resource conservation and recovery act sites, abandoned mine land sites, and brownfield sites as well. And this initiative is really beneficial for some important reasons. First of all, these contaminated land sites often have substantial acreage, and developers of renewable energy projects in general often need acreage to become feasible. And oftentimes these contaminated land sites do not have as much competition because they have been contaminated, and so they're suitable sites for renewable energy reuse projects. Additionally, the communities around these sites typically need some kind of economic stimulation or would benefit from economic stimulation that these projects can create, especially if they're going to generate a substantial amount of power into the grid. So with that said, going on to slide number 5, this leads into my project, which my project has the general goal of assessing community involvement strategies and community, and also finding out community involvement opinions of renewable energy reuse projects on Superfund sites. And as I said, this kind of has been applied now to contaminated land sites in general. And I broke down this initial goal into 3 main questions, which I'll be answering throughout the course of my presentation. The first question is, when should community involvement for renewable energy reuse on Superfund sites be considered? And the brief answer, which will be covered more in my presentation, is that before community involvement may occur, other factors must be taken into account. And I mean community involvement specifically for the renewable energy reuse portion of the project. And I'll be talking about those factors in a moment. Second question, how should the EPA be involved in community involvement for renewable energy reuse on Superfund sites? And I really have found that through my research, the EPA should be involved as a liaison to maybe facilitate connections between a developer and the community, or as an information source between the community or for the community if the community is interested in a renewable energy reuse project, which has occurred in one of the case studies that I'll be focusing on, the Brockton site in Massachusetts. And lastly, the last question I wanted to answer is, what tools could help address community interest in renewable energy reuse on Superfund sites? And I now have a compilation of tools from community involvement coordinators. A lot of them are ideas that could come to fruition someday that I'll be discussing as well. Moving on to slide 6, my methodology for this project is fairly simple. I did qualitative interviews with community involvement coordinators via the phone. But the first piece that I wanted to talk about are the interviews that I did on renewable energy reuse sites, which I selected 2 sites that I knew had successful renewable energy reuse. And the first one that I'll be talking about is the Brightfields project in Brockton, Massachusetts, which is a brownfield site, and they developed a solar panel, or a solar field, excuse me, on this site. And I talked with various individuals who have been involved in that project. And additionally, I selected the Steel Winds site, which is a wind turbine site in Lackawanna, New York, which the site was a non-national priority listed Superfund site, and it was turned into a brownfield site later on. And additionally, as I mentioned earlier, I did 21 interviews with community involvement coordinators to try and assess any knowledge that they have of renewable energy reuse projects and community involvement components to those projects. So I did 2 CICs in each region, and it just so happened I did 3 in Region 9. And I tried to pick 1 community involvement coordinator in each region that had some kind of renewable energy reuse project, so I kind of knew that it was already there. And then I tried to pick, or it could have been a green remediation project, because I feel that if there's a green remediation, which means renewable energy is used somehow in the cleanup of the site to power something with regard to cleanup, that some of the community involvement tools that are used for the green remediation could also someday be applied to renewable energy reuse at the site. And lastly, I also picked a community involvement coordinator that I was more random, so there wasn't necessarily any known renewable energy reuse or green remediation. Moving on to slide 7, the main findings of my project are noted on this slide. First of all, I really found that multiple factors need to be understood when you're first considering renewable energy reuse on a site. And the main categories of renewable energy reuse that I was looking at, mainly it was developer-driven utility scale projects. That's what I found mostly. I also, as I noted, there's one instance, one of my case studies deals with the utility community-driven project, the Brockton site. And those were the two main types of projects that I looked at. There are definitely other ones. There's off-grid power that you can also analyze, such as renewable energy reuse that is powering a renewable energy source that's powering a specific location on a site, such as a light fixture in some part of a community park, for instance. Okay. But I didn't really find those much, so I didn't really look at those in this project.
Okay,
so that being said, the factors that I found are, first, that all projects, no matter in either of those two categories, you need to look at the community interests first. So what does the community want the project, what does the community want the site to be? If they want the site, or really set on the site being a community park, then obviously then a renewable energy reuse project such as a massive solar field may not be the best
site.
So analyzing that first is very important. Additionally, taking into account with utility community-driven projects, public utility grid issues and legislative barriers, and again, I'm going to be focusing on the Brompton site with regard to this second step. And then third, if it's a developer-driven utility-scale project, initial engineering studies need to be conducted first, because oftentimes developers are setting for these projects and they need to know that this has a renewable energy reuse potential before anything else.
Laura, I'm sorry to interrupt. This is Jean. I'm going to globally mute everyone because you've got a lot of background.
Yeah, what's the post-it?
Okay.
So what's going to happen, I'm going to hit a command. There's going to be an announcement to everyone. The phone lines have
been muted. Oh, yeah, I hit it about 11.
When you hear that announcement, Laura, I want you to then hit #6.
That'd be perfect.
Okay.
And then you'll be able to continue talking. Pam, the same thing goes for you. You'll have to hit #6 when you're ready to speak so you can talk through the mute. I apologize for the disruption, everyone.
The leader has muted your line.
Okay, and I'm back. So with these factors in mind, then the next question separately is, how does community involvement relate into or fit into the renewable energy reuse project with these factors in mind? And that I need to bring in my discussions with community involvement queries for this, because really there's two end of the spectrums that I found from their perspectives. And the first one is that don't let the community know the renewable energy reuse possibilities early on, because it will confuse them. They won't know what's going on if it turns out that the site is not feasible for renewable energy reuse, and it will cause problems. The other end of the spectrum is that the community should always know and be presented with renewable energy reuse possibilities early on. So these are rather contradictory opinions. And so what I've come to the conclusion throughout my project and based on the case studies that I conducted is that the factors that I mentioned previously on this slide need to be taken into account and well understood. And then once they are, then you can bring the community involvement aspect into the reuse portion of the project. And as a side note, from an EPA perspective, if this occurs at an early stage in the cleanup process, then the EPA can have more of a role in the community involvement process, because once the site is deleted from the National Priorities List, or once the site has entered into a 5-year review process, it's much more difficult for the EPA to have a role in the site. And that doesn't mean the community involvement won't occur, obviously. It's just the EPA won't be as involved from an oversight role, potentially. So additionally, I also discovered that developer-driven renewable energy reuse projects are very favorable as long as the developer has a community involvement focus early on. It's a front-loaded process. They're going out and reaching out to the community early on. And they're also willing to work with the project team if the site is still in the cleanup phase. So with that said, moving on to slide number 8, I just outlined the case studies that I'm going to talk about, starting with the Brightfield project, moving on to Lackawanna, then going on to the Abtex fiber site, and finally concluding with the Nebraska Ordnance Plant site. So moving on to slide number 9, the Brightfield project, which is located in Brockton, Massachusetts, is a solar project, a solar field, and it was a community-driven project. And really, it began with the dedication and experience of one individual in the community, Lori Ribeiro, who we are privileged to have her on the call with us today. And she was the brownfields coordinator at the site. She was contracted for it. And she noticed that developers were approaching the brownfield, but they were developers who had a tendency for pollution, such as auto body shops and tire factory producers. And so as a result, she realized that these were not beneficial for the community based on the community's history of having a lot of industrial facilities in the site, and that the community might want something that's a little bit different. And so she actually went out, and she was inspired by the Department of Energy's Brownfields to Brightfields program, and she went out and started to look at different developers and found a solar developer that was intrigued in the project. And so she approached the city council and also the ward leader for the community who would be affected by the project. And while underneath the first bullet point of the barriers, there was some initial skepticism and hesitation even from these individuals about this project, because it was such a new idea, and they hadn't really thought about this before. But once it was explained to them and any questions were answered, then it was pretty favorable to these leaders. And then that's where the community involvement strategy really kicked in, with the first bullet underneath the community involvement strategy piece, which is early and complete involvement with all stakeholders. And they held ward meetings, they held public meetings, the solar developer came to answer questions, they had experts there to answer questions, and the community was able to express any concerns they had. And their concerns primarily revolved around aesthetics, and noise and pollution issues. And really, one of the main focuses was that there would be additional power lines created by this project, which from an aesthetic standpoint, which isn't the case, and that was explained, that the power generated by these solar panels would feed into the existing power lines. And additionally, once these fears were laid, then the concern was not about the solar project. It became about the fence that was surrounding the brownfield. And the community was fixated on this, and they didn't want to hear anything else until this fence project was addressed. And so what they ended up wanting is the Bay State Gas Company, who was the responsible party in this case, to go ahead and design a new fence for the site. And once this was agreed to, they actually brought in a landscape architect and designed a new fence. Then the community was extremely supportive of the project from all angles, it seemed. And there was a lot of community momentum behind the project. But the incorporation of the community desires from the very beginning of the project was really important in the success of this project from a community involvement perspective. And if they had not listened to the community in this regard, the project most likely would not have been as supported by the community. And additionally, some other barriers, which I alluded to in the beginning of my presentation, were that there were legal problems with regard to this specific site. In the Brockton site, the community was going to own the utility. And as a result, there were specific statutes in the Massachusetts law that prohibited them, if they were a public utility, from taking advantage of certain grants and funding, such as the Renewable Energy Trust Fund in Massachusetts. And so Lori led the charge once again to go and change some of the legislation in the Massachusetts laws to make it so that they would be able to take advantage of these funding opportunities. Other projects in the future in Massachusetts would also be able to do so. So this is a barrier that came about and could come about in other states. If there's any other community-driven projects that want to do something like Brockton, so it's something that needs to be thought about in other areas as well. And the result is that now there's excitement and community support of this project. So moving on to slide number 10, the Lackawanna project in Lackawanna, New York. It's a wind and developer-driven project. So right now there are about 8 wind turbines on this site, and they're up and running. And the main community involvement strategy really began, and I included this because I think it has potential at other sites too, with the University at Buffalo, some students did a preliminary, basically, report about wind potential in the greater Buffalo area. And while this didn't specifically target the Lackawanna site for wind power development, it spurred additional interest and research in this area for eventual site development for wind power. And I bring this up because I feel that this is something that could be taken advantage of at other areas. You could involve universities more for some of the initial engineering work potentially in the future, and this could cut down on some of those initial costs that that developers need to know whether this site would be a good source for a renewable energy project, and incorporating universities somehow could be a very effective means of community involvement in this regard. And as a result, BQ Energy, which now is under a different name that I've noted in the slides, became interested in the site and did a lot of the same things that the Brockton site did, but from a developer's perspective. Again, informing the community early on, met with the mayor, the city council, they had one-on-one meetings with other members in the community, and really got behind the project and really wanted the community to know what was going on from an early stage, which was extremely beneficial because they found that people were really supportive of the project, and as a result, the project today has a lot of community support behind it still. And so they also did a lot of things using visual tools, looking at the wind turbines from different angles, like showing people how it would look to them, which is very important from the aesthetic standpoint. And so that was extremely important as well. Now, the barriers were, again, initial skepticism and lack of understanding. Some people hadn't really seen wind turbines before. Most people hadn't, actually. So they took some of the members of the city council out to see a wind turbine that was about an hour away. And once they had allayed fears, again, of aesthetics and noise issues, then people were pretty supportive of the project. What's interesting is now they're about ready to try and site some additional turbines, and it's looking like there's now more community interest in some of the issues with wind turbines. Like, they're wanting them now to site or to do some additional bird studies potentially and look at some other things that they hadn't even considered with the first set of wind turbines, which is interesting. It's almost because now that there's more understanding of the process, now the community has more questions than they did before. And additionally, something that came out, I talked to Paul Fran, who's the senior executive vice president of Apex Wind Energy and Axio Power, and he said that citizens felt in this instance and also other instances in sites that he works on that this site would not be fully cleaned up if the renewable energy reuse project went through. Now, in this case, BQ Energy was helping. Actually, they had been assigned the cleanup process right around the wind turbines, so they were able to explain to the community exactly how that was going to work at the community hearings they had, and they were once again able to allay their fears in this regard as well. However, it's something that needs to be thought about at different contaminated land sites that have renewable energy reuse projects. And another barrier was that there was an absence of the school district in funding negotiations. What ended up happening with regard to funding is that BQ Energy promised to pay the city $100,000 a year for 15 years for the 8 turbines that were going to be constructed initially. And as a result, and this was in lieu of taxes, and the school district had no part in these negotiations, so when this came to light, there was quite a lot of community controversy around this specific fact. And BQ Energy, it wasn't their fault because they didn't know this. It was really between the city and the school district. However, it's important to take this lesson to just kind of incorporate, if there's any kind of funding issue going on, which there normally would be with a project like this, to figure out exactly who should be involved in those negotiations. And the result is that there is a really successful completion of the first project. The mayor of the city has been able to lower property taxes because of this, and there's the second project in discussion, and now the school district is involved in negotiations for the upcoming turbines that are going to be sited. Moving on to slide 11.
The Apex a quick time check for you.
Sure.
We've got about 30 minutes left.
Okay. Going on to the Apex Fiber site, which is a super fun site, as I mentioned, in Front Royal, Virginia. It has a projected solar project that's going to be located on the site. And again, it's developer-driven. Sola Verde has been approaching the city, and they're presenting their plan to the city council right now. And from what I've been able to find in terms of literature online, it's been very supported by the city council thus far, but it's still in negotiations. And there really is an excellent use. Oh, and so really they're kind of using a similar strategy from the Lackawanna and Brockton sites by approaching the community early on in the process. And there's really an excellent use of community involvement tools. In this case, I spoke with Larry Johnson, who's the community involvement coordinator of this site. And he, now that he's aware of the fact that this site is having a renewable energy reuse discussion, he's incorporating that into the community involvement plan, which he's reworking for the site. And he's doing the door-to-door interviews, talking to people, and asking them their opinions of the renewable energy components of this project and the reuse, and getting people's opinions. And so far it's been pretty favorable, but it's a good example of how community involvement coordinators can integrate ways to assess community opinion in their everyday work. And additionally, there were barriers, like before, there were aesthetic concerns about the solar panels, which haven't been addressed yet, but they should be able to be addressed based on, just like the other case studies we've already mentioned. And as Vice Mayor of the city said, the devil was in the details. So there could be similar problems for the Brightfield project and the Lackawanna project that need to be addressed in the future, but it's important to look at those examples of those other sites, and you could apply them to this site. The results, again, it's still in the planning process. However, the developer is proposing a solar training academy, which is a great way to integrate the community into this project, which would help train students to operate the solar panels and also have them understand better how the solar panels are working. So going on to slide number 12, the Nebraska Ordnance Plant. It's a biofuels and developer-driven project, and really the community. And what happened was the Nebraska E3 Biofuels was the company that was running the plant, and it was going to be a closed loop process for ethanol production. And what ended up happening is they had a community involvement strategy. They held public meetings and attracted national attention to the project, just like in some of the other sites we discussed. But the fact of the matter was the process was not sustainable over the long term. And as a result, the plant actually closed, and E3 Biofuels is now bankrupt, and there were job losses in the community because of this. So even though there was a community involvement component to this, it seems fairly strong from what I can gather. The fact that it seems like there was some kind of lack in the financial sustainability over the long term. And as a result, the project was not successful, and so the community ended up being hurt by this. So moving on to slide 13, how do we relate these community involvement cases to other Superfund sites? Moving on to slide 14, I just want to briefly talk about the community involvement flowcharts that I've created. And so moving on to slide 15, we're starting with tier ones. These are just factors that you should take into account if you are interested in a renewable energy reuse project on a Superfund site. So first of all, are the people who are involved with the project, which I'll be talking about on the next slide, interested in renewable energy reuse? And so first of all, you need to talk about what kind of renewable energy reuse. Is it utility scale, going right into the grid or off-grid, and what kind of renewable energy, because that will determine what kind of community involvement you're going to have later on. And this usually comes from interest in the community of a landowner or interest from a developer or a combination of both. Going on to slide 16, the people who you should be figuring out if they're interested in renewable energy reuse are who owns the land, who has a stake in the land, so the developer, the community, the landowner, or the potentially responsible party, potentially. And it's important to identify these people early on in these groups. And then who is in charge of the cleanup? This is really important if it's during the cleanup phase. If it's afterwards, it may not be quite as important. And while the EPA has oversight in any case, but if it's a federal facility or a state weed site, they're probably the ones who are going to have more of the community involvement focus to the project. So the EPA can provide a support role in this case. Moving on to slide number 17. When is tangible reuse a focus? This is important to figure out. If it's from the very start, this could be problematic, because if you find other things in the site that more contamination, for instance, the site can morph over time, then that might impact when you can have a renewable energy project, or what kind of renewable energy project you can have if you find more contamination at a certain point. So it seems like sometime during the cleanup, number two might be the best point in time once you understand the site a little better. And number three, after the cleanup, again, as I mentioned, EPA's influence has decreased by this point. That's not necessarily bad. You can still have community involvement from a developer standpoint, from the community, the city, or another entity. And secondly, developers may be interested in the site earlier. Like with regards to the Lackawanna site, it was being the reuse project was taking place before cleanup had occurred, and this could occur at Superfund sites as well. If the developer is interested in the site earlier, why not go ahead and take advantage of that interest and start generating revenue for the community? Moving on to slide number 18, potential barriers. There's the project's renewable energy feasibility. Is it a good site for renewable energy? So there's engineering studies, use universities if possible, funding issues. Is it sustainable over the long term? The Nebraska Ordinance Plan is a good example where that wasn't taken into consideration, it seems, as much. And lastly, liability issues. Will the developer or the community be liable if they begin construction on the property? Moving on to slide 19, community involvement potential and existing tools. So once you've taken those factors into account and you've gone through those tiers, the last four tiers, then you can really look at specific community involvement tools for the renewable energy reuse. And from my discussions with community involvement coordinators and RPMs, it seems like Superfund renewable energy remediation projects already have some of those tools in place. For instance, the Otis Air Force Base in Cape Cod, Massachusetts has wind power that they're using to power some of the remediation on the site, and they already have tools. The Air Force has developed really good PowerPoints for this that could be applied to Superfund sites for renewable energy reuse. And also in Grand Prairie, Texas, there's solar panels that are powering a vapor intrusion system. As I mentioned, the other contaminated land sites, both developer and also, I didn't mention on here, but community-driven projects have tools that have been created already that we could take advantage of. And also international work. I was looking online and did some research, and the Environment Council, as an example, they produced a final report in 2005. It's in the UK, and it's entitled Renewable Energy and Community Involvement. And it's a really great document. It doesn't consider contaminated land sites specifically, but it has some really great recommendations that, for instance, emphasize early community involvement in collaboration with the developer. Moving on to slide number 20. Really, in conclusion, the recommendations that I have are directly from the community involvement coordinator conversations that I had. They gave me some really great ideas based on their extensive experience at Superfund sites. So first of all, creating a guidance document for community involvement regarding renewable energy reuse. Something similar to the UK model that I mentioned would be really, really great to have for our Superfund sites or contaminated land sites in general. And additionally, a state-by-state guidance document for communities who want to create their own utility power source. So referring back to the Brockton site, even though that's one specific project, if there was some kind of state-by-state guidance document that could walk a community through how to do that in their own state, because utility laws vary state-by-state, so it would be very difficult potentially for other communities in different states to do something similar to what Brockton did. And if they wanted to do that, it would be very useful to have some kind of guidance document that's state-specific. Going on to tools for writing documents in other languages and some kind of searchable database for renewable energy reuse projects would be great, and the results of those, because then you could search it if you have a community interested in a project like this and pull up a project that potentially has a similar population size and figure out a similar renewable energy source and figure out and look at exactly what happened in that community and show those results to the community that you're working with, because there are lots of instances and examples of this. And additionally, creating a more official information exchange for existing educational tools like from green remediation sites, from other contaminated land sites, the visual aids, and also some kind of cost-saving calculator for renewable energy projects that you can show communities to show the cost-effectiveness of a renewable energy project, and adding renewable energy reuse educational training tools, maybe getting it into the schools a little more so you can get the community involvement going at that stage if you have a project that you're looking at. Going on to slide number 21, some general good practices, more of a focus on reuse at an earlier stage once the scope of the site is understood. And then also having EPA or another entity facilitating the engineering studies. The National Renewable Energy Laboratories is doing some of this right now, but also utilizing the power, as I mentioned earlier, of universities for this would be really great. And then focused communication among CICs, RPMs, and Superfund redevelopment coordinators, and also offering more advice for financial and technical issues, and I put a link to a database on there, and additionally communicating with community involvement conscious developers and highlighting renewable energy reuse in the community involvement plan or in other areas of community involvement coordinator work as much as possible, integrating what's already there with what could be possible with renewable energy reuse. And lastly, some trainings that I think could be useful are community involvement university course on renewable energy and EPA developer training for community involvement, which was brought up in the UK documents that I mentioned. And for more information, I've included links to the documents that I used for this project and the theses by Lori and also Jonathan for the Bright Fields and Steelwinds projects from their MIT theses, and then also the international work, the Environment Council report I mentioned. And going on to slide 23, sorry, that being said, please welcome Pam Swingle, who will be talking about more existing tools for renewable energy reuse and renewable energy potentials.
Oh, no.
Hello. Okay, we can hear you.
Okay. Well, I sure thought I hung up on myself, so.
You're
right. So, well, thanks again to Laura for all her great presentation, because we're going to learn a lot from what her interviews are with community involvement folks. So, but I'm here to talk about some of the tools that OSWR's Center for Program Analysis has developed in cooperation with Superfund Brownfields, our ALPS program federal facilities. Superfund's been an integral partner for us in developing the map. So I want to direct you to the first slide that talks about when it was launched, and it just shows that we have developed these tools and look, and we see the opportunity to use renewable energy, use these sites for renewable energy development. And today we've mapped over 13 million acres, and I'll talk a little bit about that in a minute. I'm not going to go over the next slide, which is too much, but it's why do we focus on these sites? Because I think Laura did a great job of talking about this, that many times these sites have adequate zoning, they have great existing infrastructure with transmission lines and roads, and the NIMBY issue is less relevant for community involvement coordinators. You guys understand that very well working on your sites. And there's a list of other things that these sites may provide, including, you know, more economic value to the site and other opportunities for the community in reusing these sites instead of greenfields. So let's go to the next slide, which is who's the audience for our tools and so forth that we developed. Well, this started off to really get developers, investors, really, and owners interested in looking at the EPA track sites as opportunities for siting renewable energy. And it's evolved into really trying to reach down into our community leaders and our state and local folks, and we've seen a lot of interest in the tools that we've developed so far. So the next slide is the repowering tool. That's really what I'm here to talk to you all about today. I'm going to go over these fairly briefly, and then you guys you can contact us at any time. Myself or Laura Matthews, our contact information will be at the end. We have Google Earth mapping tool that maps all the EPA track sites that we discussed earlier. We have success stories on our website, including some of those that Laura talked about earlier, and we have fact sheets on those. We also have incentive and static maps for each of the states. The incentive fact sheets show the renewable energy incentives on one side and then the contaminated land redevelopment incentives on the other side of the fact sheet. So they're a great tool for you to take to your communities and work with your states. And then technical assistance, and we'll talk a little bit about that. There's also, you'll see the website at the bottom there that you can go to. And one thing about the website, I want to let you guys know that we are in the process of doing some updates. There's a lot of new maps that will be going up and updated maps. Those should be up in the next week or two. So we'll send something out to those folks that are participating on the call. I think we can do that through Eugene or somebody, but we'll be updating that. So please come back to it in a couple weeks, because I do think you'll see it's a lot more user-friendly. So let's talk about the Google Earth mapping tool. It's on your next slide. And I said we mapped EPA track sites and we used screening criteria based on solar potential, wind potential, and we also have biofuel potential on our sites. We also are getting ready to map geothermal and landfill gas methane production potential as energy use. Those will not be on this round of updates that come up, but we should be up in the next month or so. That'll be another round of updates. On the mapping tool, we have infrastructure data. We have the highways, we have the states, we have the railroads, and we also have some transmission line data. So let's go to the next slide. I wanted to give you guys a sense of what the Google Earth mapping tool looks like. And if you go to our EPA, our site that you saw, you'll see it where you can download Google Earth and get to these maps. If you look at this first slide, it shows all of our brownfields, Superfund, RCRA, federal facility sites listed. And you'll notice it says non-federal Superfund and then federal Superfund. And the federal Superfund are our federal facilities in general that we talk about. And you'll notice on the left, there's a series. If you've worked in Google Earth at all, you'll know some of this. But if you look to the left, under places, you'll see that everything is selected for potential right now so that you can see all the sites on there. And these are the different layers that you can search for. So then move to the next slide. And what this shows is that I deselected everything but utility and community wind potential for our sites. And these are utility scale projects are large, usually have large tracts of land, so you have a lot of abandoned mine sites. You see some RCRA facilities there also and some brownfields. And then there's community wind that also has to have a certain amount of acreage. You'll see at the top the yellow is abandoned mine lands and the purple is brownfields, and I want you to pay attention to that as we move to the next slide. So let's move to the next slide. So what I did here is I only selected abandoned mine land and brownfields for community and utility wind potential. And you'll see it narrows it down significantly on what our sites, what our renewable energy laboratory, DOE's renewable energy laboratory provided the data for the wind and solar resources that we have. So these are the sites that are left. One thing that I do want to tell you is that we did a pilot project with Region 3, and that information is going up on this new version of the website, where Region 3 called us and said, hey, it looks like there's no solar potential here, but we're seeing solar go up on some of our sites. So why is that? Well, when you add the dynamics of the energy incentives at the state, their energy portfolios at each state, it dramatically increases the potential of renewable energy on your site. So if you have states that has a renewable energy portfolio and has incentives to site solar or wind, you go back and you have to kind of look at the maps and say, okay, we have these sites, so what does it mean for that state? And so we ended up going back on a pilot with Region 3 and looking at those states with incentives. So it's real interesting how much is happening there as a result of those incentives. So if you go to the next slide, I wanted to show you the power of the website. You can focus in closer as you go on in, and then if you click one more slide, this is an actual site that is a mine site. And you'll see that you can see the area of the mine site and the roads and so forth and the power of Google Earth. And then if you click to the next slide, when you click on that little yellow dot, it will pull up this information about the site. And it'll show the acreage. And I want you to also notice that there's EPA cleanup program information. If you click on that link, it takes you to the existing data that's available to the public on this site. So if it's on our RCRA info or if it's on the cleanup database, whatever information's on there to the public will be there. It also has the data guideline document link at the down near the bottom of that list of stuff that shows you how that we screened and so forth for each of these sites. So it's a very powerful tool. You get this kind of information for each of the sites that we have. So it also looks at the wind and solar potential and bio energy potential there. So then let's go to the next slide. The incentive fact sheets, I talked about them a little bit, and I want to give everybody plenty of time to answer questions, so I'm going to go through these fairly quickly. The incentive fact sheets that we have the funding, the current grants, loans, and bonds that are available for siting renewable energy, and as well as development of contaminated lands, like I said. There's also the tax abatements deduction, and then other resources that might be out there as far as technical assistance contacts and limited liability information if they have something in addition to what we have at EPA. We also have a federal incentive fact sheet that was just updated recently, and as many of you know, with the stimulus packet, there's tons of new stuff happening every day. So I know Laura had the desire database in her presentation. I highly recommend you all go to that because it is keeping real-time information about the current renewable energy incentives that are going on throughout the states. So where our fact sheets are fairly static, these were done in March, I'm sure there's new information on them because it seems like every week we're hearing where another state has something else coming up. So I just be sure that you keep up with the desire database. Then we have the individual state maps on solar, wind, and biopower, where you can use these as a resource for your for whatever state you're working in. So it shows what are the solar, wind, and biopower for the maps. So. And then if you move to the next slide, I've got two success stories there, and I'm not actually one of them was one of Laura's she talked about, which is great. And the other one is Summitville Mine, which is more of a green remediation project that we have a Superfund site. But it also powers 25 homes, which we were very excited about. So it's kind of a community power resource also. So next slide. Our additional website resources that are on there, we have tools and guidance for mine site redevelopment that we've gotten from the Superfund program that has been really great to have on the site. We have the revitalization handbook from the Brownfield program, and we also have limited liability resources on the site. And the new site will also have additional links to other federal agencies that are working in renewable energy. So, and then the last step is really what I want to talk to you guys about on the next steps, because the work that Laura did over the summer in her internship is going to be really beneficial for us to continue the dialogue on the Repower project and what are our next steps, what do we need to do. So we're very excited to see all those recommendations and see how we can incorporate them into our future activities. For the state and regional input, we want to increase the dialogue, doing things like this with the community involvement coordinators and the RPMs and so forth in the regions and also our states. We need input on the existing tools. What's the usefulness of it? What else do you guys need? We're also getting ready to have some stakeholder meetings throughout the country. Those will happen later this year in the fall and in the first of the year. We're hoping to have five throughout the country, and we're looking at locations now. But to do that, what the purpose of stakeholder meetings is really to expand our partnerships with the other federal, state, local organizations, bring industry in, and really look at the barriers, look at some of the liability issues and the perceptions we have on our sites, and also, you know, what's our next steps? What we'd like to have out of those stakeholder meetings at the end is a two-year action plan for the repowering project. What's the next steps that we need to take? And your feedback to Laura can certainly and should be incorporated in some of these discussions. So next slide is next steps continued. We're doing site overhaul, and we're having continuous updates. Like I said, there'll be a new site coming up within the next couple weeks. But the geothermal and landfill methane sites will be coming up hopefully in the next month or so after that. The mapping is almost complete, and we're very excited about getting the geothermal potential, well, actually both of those. We are also entering into an interagency agreement with NREL, the National Renewable Energy Laboratory, through DOE. And we're very excited about that. Many of you may have heard about the pilot projects at the regions, where the regions submitted potential projects for feasibility studies to site renewables on various sites. We have selected 13 sites across the country from the regions, and we're working on the interagency agreement now. They vary. They're from Superfund green remediation to utility scale studies also. They're wind and solar, and we have one hydropower in Region 3, I believe. So we do have some brownfield projects in there. I think there's 5 brownfield projects and 4 Superfund, 1 federal facility, 1 oust, and 1 RCRA site. So you guys will be hearing more about that, and if you have additional questions about that, you can certainly call us. And we can tell you, if you don't know who in your region is working on those, we can certainly let you know. Then, so the last slide is our contact information, and just to say thank you, and thank you to Laura for including us in the webinar, because we think community involvement coordinators are a very important part of what we do, so that we can start those communications with community before it gets too far down the road, so that they're aware of what's going on. So there's our contact information. Laura Matthews is my colleague and my partner in crime. So you can call either one of us if you have any questions. And that's it. I think they're going to open the phones now for questions, right, Jean?
Yep, that's exactly correct. For those of you who are joining us on the telephone lines, if you'd like to ask a question of the speaker, I have muted your lines on our telephone line. I'm going to hit the unmute command, so all of the lines will be unmuted. If you've locally muted using your own button, you'll have to unmute that way as well, but you'll be welcome to go ahead and just speak up and ask a question. So give me 1 second while I hit the unmute button, and we'll let everyone on the phone lines ask if they have a question.
The leader has unmuted your line.
So, again, the phone lines are open. If you are on the phone lines and you have a question, feel free to just speak up. I heard someone on the phone. Okay, well, if anyone on the phone line does have a question, you can speak up. I do have questions that were submitted online. I'm going to start with those. The first one's coming in from Los Angeles, California, and this was actually submitted when Laura was going through her materials. I believe this is in relation to the Buffalo example that you gave. But they asked, how long did it take to get the site up, and how much extra time did it add to the project for cleanup?
Oh, hey, this is Laura. So the question was, how long did it take to get it up?
Yeah, they want to know how long did it take to get the site up.
I don't remember the exact timeline. Like, I think it was, with regard to discussions and everything, I want to say, I don't know the exact time. If you look at the thesis online, I think it was a span of about 5 years, if I'm correct, but the document, the thesis that I cited online in my presentation at the end of my document has that information in detail. They actually break it down in the thesis for the different steps that the project took, and it also has the information of exactly how much money went into the project as well, because it's already been developed. So I don't want to give a false answer.
That was great. And the gentleman from Los Angeles, if you need a further clarifying question or further clarifying answer from Laura, feel free to shoot her an email afterwards. The next question that came in online is coming in from Washington, D.C., and they ask, how was the issue of the citizens feeling that the Lackawanna site would not be fully cleaned up if renewable energy reuse was implemented dealt with? And this pertains to barriers on slide number 10. How was this barrier overcome?
That's a good question, and I actually got that information from Paul Curran, as I think I mentioned during presentation. And he's the senior executive vice president of the company now. And he's the one who mentioned that to me. I don't know if your question's pertaining to exactly what specific cleanup information they had to give the community. I'm not sure what that was, but I asked him how he was able to allay their fears, and he said that just once they explained to the community in detail the cleanup process for how they were going to continue on with the cleanup as the wind turbines were sighted on the site, that was enough to go on with the project and have community support for the project.
Okay, great. The next question comes in again from Los Angeles, and they're asking if the CICs are from the EPA.
Yes, they are. So, yeah, I'm sorry I didn't explain that. The community operators are EPA employees that are assigned to each Superfund site, and so they're all EPA employees.
Okay, great. Another question coming in from Washington, D.C. that asks, did any of the community involvement activities involve tribal governments?
No, that's a good question. I didn't. With some of the community involvement coordinators I spoke with had experience with tribal governments, but I didn't. They didn't have any instances of renewable energy projects that I found from the community involvement coordinators that I spoke with that involved tribal lands or tribal governments.
Okay, this is just one last call. Great, thank you, Laura. I appreciate that. If anyone on the phone lines has a question for the speakers, I know we're just past our scheduled end time, but if you do have a question, feel free to speak up right now on the phone lines. If you've muted using our command, simply hit the #6 button to unmute your line.
Hey, I just submitted online. It's Andrew Hackler from Los Angeles.
Hi, Andrew.
Quick question. What are the most... When you're talking to stakeholders and landholders,
Hi, are we available?
Anyway, when you're
talking, go ahead, Andrew.
That's okay. When you're talking to stakeholders or landholders that we're tracking, what are the most sort of benefits that the EPA can offer these people in order to get them, incentivize them to repurpose their land with renewable energy? So when I'm talking to say, private owner of land, and I said, look, the EPA's got Repower America. They will help do this, this, and this if you repurpose your land with renewable energy.
What should be allowed today? Okay,
I'm going to defer that question to Pam just because I feel that she has more experience in that area than I do. I have some ideas, but I think she could speak better to that.
Hi, Laura. And, thanks for the question. This is a great question because that's what we are, you know, trying to communicate to folks all the time. We do have, first of all, we really need people to the state incentives because that seems to be driving it for folks a lot right now because some of the states have great, especially, you know, in California, you know you guys have great incentives there. So we're seeing a lot of interest from developers from those states that have those incentives.
Hey, Robbie, this is Andrew. I was just looking at the file and... 241641
I apologize. That's someone doesn't right. have their phone on mute. I apologize.
That's all right. If you can hear me, that's great. The other thing that we have viability resources out there, and we have our great community involvement coordinators and our folks. We have a redevelopment revitalization program that works with folks to try to get these lands into productive use. So we have a variety of resources, and it really depends on where you are in state and region and what part of the cleanup, you know, what portion of the cleanup is on the site, what stage it's in.
Right. That was sort of the first question that I had. As developers, we're all looking for, you know, to get our projects. We have to do PPAs, exceptions, so forth, and so
right.
we have to time it out. You know, some of the sites that are not close to finish with their remediations, that drives the timelines pretty far out there and adds a lot of question marks. And as developers and financiers, we can't have a lot of question marks when we're putting our numbers together. We're trying to limit the question marks.
Sure, sure. Well, and we've had, for instance, the New York project, the wind project, they actually,
right.
that site hopefully cleaned up, if you're familiar with it. They were able to work with the state variances to site those wind turbines. So the whole site is not cleaned up at this point, but that portion of it, they took special action to get those wind turbines put into place. And it's been a very positive impact on that site. So it really is reflective of the folks working together with the developer and the owner to try to figure out, you know, what's the best thing for the site.
Great, thanks. That's very informative.
Okay.
Hi, thank you. Is there one last question on the phone lines?
Yes, this is Suzanne Lazorko-Conan with Emerald Environmental. I'm in Cochrane, Canada, Alberta, Canada. I was just wondering in regards to the more technical information associated with the Lackawanna site and the issues surrounding the citizens' concerns about the redevelopment of the site and the extent that the site would be redeveloped prior to the renewable energy project going ahead. Is there someone I can contact in regards to how the project moved forward during the remediation, what remediation had to be done, the extent of the remediation that was complete, and if there's any ongoing remediation that has to be done while the renewable energy project is operational?
Yeah, this is Pam, and Laura might be able to give you some more information on that, because I think she talked directly to the CEO and so forth, and we've had some conversations with them, but if you'd like to call us offline, we can certainly talk to you some more about it.
Okay, no, that sounds fine. Thank you.
Yeah, and I did talk with Paul, so and I found his email easily available online. So his name is C-U-R-R-A-N, his last name, and his first name is Paul.
Okay, and he's the project manager for the proponent that is operating and maintaining the wind farm, is that correct?
Yeah, he's with the developing group, right, and he's the senior executive of the Axio Wind Power, and there's also a solar energy component to that company as well, but if you type in Axio Wind Power, which is on the slide, and his name, then you'll be able to find his contact information.
Was his company responsible for the cleanup itself, or were the EPA involved?
No, his company, Middle Steel, is actually the company that's in charge of the overall cleanup of the site, but what ended up happening is, what he told me is that his company is responsible just for the cleanup around the wind turbines themselves. The site is a larger expanse than just what's around the wind turbines. But his company has assumed control of the cleanup for just a small portion of the site that involves the wind turbines, and that's why he was involved in communicating that part of the cleanup process to their community, because that's what they were concerned with.
So the remainder of the site still needs to be cleaned up. Is that what I'm understanding?
Absolutely, that's my understanding.
Yeah, it's quite large.
We have a brownfield site here locally that there may be some potential for renewable energy. I just want to understand how that project moved ahead with the cleanup. So, okay, so it was just...
Yeah, I know that there were negotiations for the cleanup responsibility, and his company assumed some of that.
All right, this is Shahid. Just a clarification. That portion that they developed the wind energy farm on was carved out, and they leased that property. They were responsible for that portion of the contamination, but the owner who owns the property is retaining the responsibility or the liability for the entire site.
Great.
This portion that was carved out, they leased that property, so they're only on the hook for cleaning up the portions that they put the wind towers on and the associated, footprint that's associated with putting the concrete down to support the wind towers. So it's a lease agreement, and that's what most of these, when we went to their presentation last week, most of these, they do not want to take on the liability. You want to lease the property, and the liability is retained by the owner of that property or the responsible party.
Yeah. Thanks, Shahid. And also the other point that they made was that they had a great working relationship with the state of New York on this, too, to try to figure out how to get it done. So.
Yeah, the state of New York and the state of Massachusetts under their brownfields apparently have some sort of a blanket liability protection.
Yes.
That's what they had said in their presentation.
Well, this has all been great. We're approximately 10 minutes past our scheduled end time. I'm going to cut off any further comments or questions right now. I apologize for doing so. But if you do have any other comments or questions that were not addressed or we couldn't squeeze in during the allotted time, again, you can go to the seminar homepage and you can email either of the instructors or myself directly, and we'll see to it that we can get an answer to you and respond to whatever other comments or questions you may have. At this point in time, I'm going to point everyone to go to the very last slide in the presentation package. which has the two links that I mentioned at the start of today's seminar. And the first link is going to be a link to additional resources, including not only the materials that we've covered today in the presentation, but also some of the related documents and resources that were discussed. The second link on the last slide is a link to our seminar feedback form, and we would ask if you could take a minute or two to complete that. It's a very short, simple little form. Just let us know how we did. And we really do read that and value your feedback to ensure that we can continue to deliver valuable information sessions like this one in the future. If you do need confirmation of your participation today, you can get that simply by completing the feedback form and checking the box to indicate you'd like a copy of the confirmation email sent to you, so you can keep that for your records. Again, I'm Jean Ballant with the EPA's Technology Innovation Program, and I just wanted to express my thanks and gratitude to Laura and Pam for presenting today, as well as all of the members of the audience who participated and actually had some great dialogue here. I hope that you found today's presentation a useful expenditure of your time, and do know that the entire event was recorded, so if you experience any technical difficulties and weren't able to get in and participate for the whole thing, you'll be able to download it and replay it at no charge from cluin.org/training in approximately 1 to 2 weeks. You can also sign up for our podcast to find out as soon as we post our latest archive training sessions that are available. So with that, I'd like to thank everyone. Hope you all have a great afternoon, and that I'll hear or see you again on a future Cluin Internet Seminar. Thanks, everyone. Take care.